Okay, now it's fine. Yeah, he stopped his disciples from standing up to defend him. Anything else that would show that he was really in control? Yep.
The last line, he's not at all surprised. He says, "This is your hour."
Okay. Saying, well, he recognizes what's going on. Okay, this is it.
His confrontation of Judas also.
Right. How does that show that he was in control and what he said to Judas?
Just like he knew everything that was going to happen. He let Judas know that. Okay. This wasn't a surprise to him.
Right. So it would seem confusing if he wouldn't have, you know, you put yourself in that position, you see somebody that you trust coming up to you, it would be a normal greeting. But he doesn't accept it as a normal greeting. He sees it for what it really is, betrayal. And so it had to be startling to Judas, too. Judas probably had an inkling that this was going to happen, because you remember when he was at the table with Jesus, and Jesus said, do what you do, do it quickly. Judas knew exactly what was being spoken of. Anything else that would show a little of the irony, a little of the fact that Christ knew exactly what was going on here?
I suppose when he was saying that am I causing a problem here?
Why? That was a logical question, because why would it be that he would be arrested at this time? What was he doing at that particular time that would be reason for him to be arrested? There's nothing. he was out in the garden praying. That was certainly nothing that he was doing wrong. He asked if he was leading a rebellion or something. There was no reason for him to be arrested. In the class that we just talked about, there was an interesting question I thought would be interesting for us to talk about too. Would it have been necessary for Judas to betray Jesus, considering everything else that was going on?
Somebody would have had to.
Well, that's true. According to the prophecy, somebody had to do it, didn't they? But did it look like Jesus was trying to run away from what was going on there? I mean, all he would have had to do was say that this is where Jesus is, right? He wouldn't have had to actually go up and follow through with the kiss, would he? Because they easily would have known that this was Jesus. Jesus was perfectly willing to identify himself, but that scripture was fulfilled, then he did that too. Let's see.
Well, so there's a question though. Those people that came looking for him to arrest him, would they have known him? Maybe not.
Maybe not. That's possible. And it's dark there too, I suppose. Maybe they would not have recognized him.
Night too, yeah.
But it certainly doesn't look like Jesus is trying to offer any resistance, does it? As a matter of fact, he stops them. Well, let's get into the questions that are with this section. There are two questions. The first one refers to Judas' kiss. Why does Jesus seem surprised that Judas would betray him with a kiss?
He knew it was going to happen.
Right.
Did he do it for the other disciples' benefit?
It was more of an announcement, wasn't it? Because what does he say about the kiss? He just says, "Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" Because what is a kiss supposed to do?
That was a sign of friendship,
right?
Of you're being loyal to that person.
Yeah, it's a little
and hurt. That kiss wasn't a loyal kiss. It was for him to be identified as to be captured. So it's the opposite.
Why do they think he was surprised? I'm not so sure that he would be. I would think that he's saying, are you doing this to me by giving me the kiss? Is that what you know?
Yeah. I'm not sure I would agree with that Jesus really is surprised. It's because it would indicate that he... that seems to indicate, that question seems to indicate that he didn't know that it was coming. I don't think that's true. I think he did know it was coming, and he was just trying to point out to everybody else
the irony of
the irony of it. And didn't Jesus often do that? He would ask questions, not so much to make people to find out an answer, but to make the person think about what they were doing. And what was he trying to make Judas think about? What are you doing, Judas? Think about what you're doing here. You ever heard of the term the kiss of death?
Yeah.
All right, this is the kiss of death, wasn't it? In what ways?
Well, it identified Jesus, who they were coming to capture, and the end result was that Jesus would die because of this.
That's right. But that's not the only way it was the kiss of death either, was it? For whom else was it the kiss of death?
Judas, because that was his
Act of betrayal, wasn't it? It was his act of betrayal. It's always difficult to talk about what could have been. But Christ tried to turn him back over and over. But even with this question, I think he was trying to turn him back, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But he didn't. He didn't back away from it. Instead, he followed through. And in this case, although Christ is in control, Jesus knew it was coming. God foretold it in the Old Testament. This is one of Satan's victories, isn't it? He wins a small battle here, but it's not small for Judas. I mean, it's eternally damning for Judas that at this point he kind of speaks his own condemnation. Okay, let's go to the next question. Jesus scolds his disciples for wanting to fight for him with swords. Had Jesus sent them mixed signals in the upper room? If you'd been on the Mount of Olives with Jesus that night, would you have struck with the sword? Anybody want to try any of those questions? How about the first one? Why do you think they're scolded?
Because
well, maybe it's also goes back to this turning the other cheek thing. I don't know. I don't know.
He willingly, if they would have fought, then it would have been as if Jesus was not willing to do the Father's will as the Father had asked him. He would have been resisting the will of the Father to pay for the sins of man by willingly suffering and dying.
Go again to what's obvious and what's hidden. What kind of a kingdom would they be still thinking about if they would have to get out their swords and start fighting for him?
Earthly
kingdom, right? And yet, it's not what is seen, it's what's not seen. Christ will establish his heavenly kingdom not because of people fighting for him with swords, but by his fulfilling the Old Testament prophecies. The disciples were told that this was going to happen, and yet they continued to resist it, didn't they? And that's kind of what you're getting at. If they had resisted this, then that would have been a sign that they really weren't willing to accept what was happening to Christ in fulfillment of the Old Testament and in obedience to his Father's will. You know, not my will, but your will be done. Let this cup pass from me if you can. But now God was saying, no, it can't. And so the disciples had to accept the fact that Christ was going to have to be arrested.
The scolding thing, don't you think he was a little disappointed with them for thinking that they could fight their way out of it? Didn't they know that he had the power to get out of it himself if he wanted to?
That's true.
Maybe that's why he scolded them,
I never thought of it from that point of view, but that's really true, isn't it? If they had the eyes of faith, they would have known. He could have called the legions of angels to guard him if he would have wanted to, but he didn't. He certainly wouldn't have to rely on a couple of fishermen with a little sword, you know.
Can can I go back to the first one, the kiss? Didn't in one of the other gospels, does Jesus identify himself before Judas comes up and kiss him?
I don't know.
Doesn't he say in the garden, "Who are you looking for?" And they say, "Jesus of Nazareth," and he says, I am he.
And then Judas comes
up. And then Judas comes up and kisses. So he really...
It was unnecessary, I guess. That was the reason that it was unnecessary when we talked about it. And I think that's what you're remembering, and that's the part I had forgotten. But I think that's correct.
Why do you think back in 36 and 37, verses 36 and 37, he tells them, you know, to sell what they have and get swords?
You wonder why he would say that.
That's maybe the mixed message.
It does. It's a confusing message, isn't it?
Well, no, because not that
it had to be fulfilled that this would happen, but Christ was obviously talking about when they would actually go out and do his work. They really hadn't been sent out to do anything yet, had they? Instead, they're kind of stepping forward. Peter kept disagreeing with Christ as Christ was trying to teach him. He said, "No, you're not going to die." And then Jesus has to say, "Get behind me, Satan." "Yes, I am." You know that. And now he didn't really tell them to step forward. They kind of assumed that. Later, when he sends them out, they may need to take along things to take care of themselves, like a sword. Because when they first were sent out, they said, "Don't take anything along with you. Everything will be provided for you." But later, after the Holy Spirit comes, then they had to take care of themselves as they were going. They had to prepare for their journey. So maybe that's what this is referring to, more than the immediate supply. That's a guess on my part. Mm-hmm. Has no basis on Scripture, but it's obvious they weren't supposed to be using the sword at this point. How about if you had been there with Jesus that night, would you have struck with the sword?
I think we probably would have. Yeah. Or I think I probably would have, because I would have wanted to protect him. I mean,
yeah.
Not that he could have protected himself, obviously, but I would have thought that I would have to help him along. Right.
Yeah, I don't think we would assume that we would do any better than the disciples.
And we might also dismiss him and say, "No, we don't know him."
yeah,
that's going to be a question that we'll definitely join up with Peter on that one. But I think the point of this is that we often don't see the spiritual significance of what's going on around us. And the disciples, even though they had been told in many ways that something very significant was about to happen, he had the special meal with them, he prayed with them, he said, "Be strong, pray that you don't fall into temptation." When it came, they didn't recognize it. We couldn't expect that we would have done any better. When we see in things that are happening today, we don't see exactly what God has in mind. Sometimes we look at it from a very worldly point of view. You know, why are the things happening that happen? It's nice to be able to look back with our perspective of history and see, well, this is why this happened. But they were right in the middle of it. And we tend to focus on what's happening rather than what it means as we're trying to survive. And that's what they were doing. They were looking at survival, I think, weren't they?
Well, don't we, you know, what I said before, I would have wanted to, you know, help Jesus along, not thinking that he couldn't do it himself, but I would want to be there. And that we do that all the time. We don't look to God when he says, "Call upon me in the day of trouble." You know, we don't take our troubles and put it in his hands and then, you know, trust that he's going to take care of. We want to help along.
We want to do something.
Yeah.
Right. Let's turn to the next section, Luke 22. verses 54 to 62. Is anyone willing to read that, please? Thanks, Beth. I mean, Beth. Okay.
Then, seizing him, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance. But when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and had sat down together, Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, "This man was with him." But he denied it. "Woman, I don't know him," he said. A little later, someone else saw him and said, "You are also one of them." "Man, I am not," Peter replied. About an hour later, another asserted, "Certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean." Peter replied, "Man, I don't know what you're talking about." Just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him, "Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me 3 times." And he went outside and wept bitterly.
How could someone as bold as Peter, who had just said he would die with Jesus and it would struck with the sword, that was Peter that cut the man's ear off, now deny that Jesus simply because people were associating him with Jesus? How could that happen so quickly?
Well, after seeing it happen, it was fearful for his own life, I suppose. And I don't know, maybe possible.
He's not that much different than the other disciples. It's just that we hear about Peter, right? Because the John was even in there too, wasn't he? But we don't hear what happens to John. John knew people a little bit better. He had some friends in that area. What happened to all the other disciples?
They ran
in other directions. And so it would kind of fit with the character of Peter that he would... Maybe he'd run away first, and then after he ran away, he realized what he'd done, and then he thought, well, I said I was going to follow Jesus into death. I better get back in there and at least see what's going on. And what he really wanted to do was to kind of watch at a distance, don't you think? And he wasn't able to do what he had intended to do.
His fear of denial could also be the fact that he didn't know what was happening to Jesus on the inside, because he was on the outside, and the fear of the unknown sometimes could have led him to, "I don't want to be put in that room either," you know.
Right.
So the fear of the unknown, I think.
Right. And Peter, being the emotional person, when the emotions take you up with, you know, courage, they can as quickly let you down with fear. I remember when he was walking on water. He was showing strong faith, wasn't he? But then all of a sudden a wave came up, and then the next thing he's saying is, "Lord, help me, I'm drowning." So this was similar to that. One minute he's swinging with the sword, the next minute he's afraid of a servant girl who's accusing him. How about this one? Have you ever denied Jesus? Would you be willing to share some of the details of your denial with the class? Those are hard to do, aren't they?
I feel like I deny Jesus a lot whenever I don't speak up for him.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
By not speaking, we deny him.
Sometimes it's not convenient to be a Christian, is it? That was certainly the case for Peter. And when we know what the right thing is to do in a group and we fail to do it, that's in a way denying Christ, isn't it?
It's really easy sometimes, I think, easier possibly when the people you work with are Christians. You work with them every day, and you don't have to think twice, because you're all on the same page.
Uh-huh.
But when you when you work in the world and are dealing with a lot of things, you have to really remain strong, and that isn't always really easy.
And you have to choose the points where you are going to speak up, because sometimes you, I don't know that I'd say you can't, but there are people that could lose their jobs if they said the wrong thing at the wrong time. And you wonder, is this an appropriate time to make a statement and say that I'm a Christian? So
there's another angle to that too. If people you work with, if they know you're a Christian and they're basically not Christians, believe me, they're watching you every second.
Oh yeah.
And if you do something or maybe you say something that's just a little off,
Why is it healthy to express remorse as Peter did in verse 62, and then contrast Peter's reaction with Judas' reaction?
Well, Peter was repentant, and I don't know that Judas really came out and repented, did he?
No, I think I'd agree with you, but maybe we should kind of clarify what we mean by repenting. They were both very, very sorry that they had done what they had done.
Yeah.
But what's the repentance part of it?
They reacted differently, though.
Yeah.
Judas went out and hanged himself. He thought this is the end of the world. Peter did. He knew there was forgiveness there, I would imagine.
That's the big difference, isn't it?
Yeah.
That
you think Judas would have, no matter how big the sin, you'd think that he would have known, being a disciple, you know, walking with Christ, you know, you'd think that he would know that too.
The only thing that we can identify as the difference between Peter and Judas would be that the gift of faith that the Holy Spirit had given the two of them. And we hear that that Satan had entered Judas. We hear that earlier. In other words, that what had been, maybe had been faith at one time was now being replaced by a trusting in something else, a fear. So we don't know.
But what did... what did Judas have as his God?
Money.
Money was his God. That's why he did what he did.
Right.
Because he wanted... Greed had entered into
right.
his heart and became his God. Jesus was not his God anymore.
And so when he realized how useless his God was and he throws it back, it's like, this isn't going to help me now. And it's too late. God can't help me either. Jesus can't help me because he's going to be crucified. Nowhere to turn. So. Any other insights?
His God of money led him to despair.
But Peter's reaction was kind of interesting. I don't know. We can understand it. Why did he weep bitterly? He said he wept bitterly.
Jesus looked at him.
Okay, what did the look say?
I warned you. I told
you
this was going to happen.
I think it also was a look of forgiveness.
Okay.
Because otherwise, Jesus, wouldn't that have been a sin? It would have been, I told you so. That's a sin, isn't it? Wanting to get revenge. I mean,
yeah.
And that, I don't think that was the look. It was a look of compassion.
Yeah, wouldn't that make him cry more if Jesus looked at him and he understood, it's okay, Peter, I still forgive you.
Right.
That would probably, you know, make him realize. And think about it, then Peter would have, maybe Peter realized at that point, he's not going to get out of this. He isn't going to establish his earthly kingdom. He is going to do what he said he's going to do. He's going to go die. He's going to get put to death tomorrow. So all those things, and the fact that he couldn't even follow Jesus into death as he had promised to do, all that mixture of emotion must have just been overwhelming for him.
But I think it changed Peter a lot.
Yeah, I would agree that it changed Peter a lot.
And maybe that was the reason for it, too.
Right. It takes something like that to truly change a person, doesn't it? And yet, people really don't change. I don't know how to say that in the right way. God can change the heart, but we still end up having the same old weaknesses. Even after this, Peter still had the same problems, didn't he, with his personality. But there are times when we see that Peter's enthusiasm and emotion really carries him on and with strength, because God has given him the promise and he's allowed him to see these things happening. He still wavers. We hear other times when Peter, even after he was had this experience and the experience at Pentecost, you know, he refused to eat the meat that God showed him. He kind of waffled when he was in the presence of the Jews, even though he had told the Gentiles it was okay before. So Peter is a guy who may be changed, but you know, it doesn't make him perfect by any means, does it?
No. But I think it did. I think it did make him probably realize that he wasn't everything he wanted to be.
Yeah.
And he had growth.
Yeah.
He had some growing to do.
Yeah, this doesn't look like the Peter that's going to be the leader of the church, does it? And he was probably realizing that too. Now let's read 63 and 64, 65. If somebody would be willing to read that.
64?
63 to 65, right.
I think I can
handle
that.
Thank you. That's a short one.
The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And they said many other insulting things to him.
And what were they mocking him about? If he was really God?
Come down from the cross.
Kind of like that, right? Yeah. Come down from the cross. If you're really God, then you would know who hit you. If you're really God, then you'd be in control of the situation. But what was he doing by doing nothing? He was showing that
he was in control.
He's still in control of the situation. Yeah. You know, he's not going to play the games with them. He's going to go through and do what his father had told him to do. So over and over we see that the control of Christ, who willingly, he was like a lamb led to the slaughter. That's one of the pictures. But they wouldn't have had to lead him. He would have walked straight ahead without anybody forcing him to go. He just went through all this suffering willingly on his own. Okay, now he gets taken before the council of the elders in 66 to 71. Could someone read that, please?
Thanks. I will. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. "If you are the Christ," they said, "tell us." Jesus answered, "If I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." They all asked, "Who are you? Are you then the Son of God?" He replied, "You are right in saying I am." Then they said, "Why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips."
Okay, so that question at the end is interesting. Why do we need any more testimony? We've heard it from his own lips. So, again, would this trial have been necessary? Probably not. Because he knew what he was going to do. And then the trial, if we can even call it that, is just a joke, isn't it? Well, let's answer the questions before we get too far off here. Luke abbreviates his account. Remember we talked about how he puts details in? And that's what he does. So he abbreviates details that others, abbreviates the whole account, puts in a couple more details that the others don't have. Presents only key question that the Jewish leaders want Jesus to answer in order to convict him of blasphemy. Look into some of the other details of this trial before the Jewish council by comparing the other gospel writers' accounts of it. Did anybody do that and see some things that weren't in Luke that were in the others? Maybe you can kind of remember just from what you remember, those other trials. What did they first start off by trying to do?
They're trying to get him to admit that he's God, and that even though they don't believe him, they want him to say that.
Right.
And
how did they do that?
Jesus knew that if he said he was God, they wouldn't believe him anyway.
Okay. But remember in the other accounts, if you look in Matthew and Mark, you'll see it, but do you remember who they brought in?
Oh, they brought in people to tell lies.
Yeah, they brought in false witnesses to say something about, you remember the part where he said he can destroy this temple and raise it again in 3 days. Who in the world could do that except God? He's claiming to be God, and they completely misquoted him, and they couldn't get the witnesses to agree. It was totally unnecessary because all they would have had to do was ask Jesus, you claim to be the Messiah, are you? And he would say yes, and that's true. They would not have needed a trial. But they did it anyhow. And they even insist on making it legal, right? Look at the next question. That's really the answer, isn't it? Why did this trial take place at daybreak?
They didn't want too many people involved, I guess.
Well, remember they had the trial at night, but now they have another one during the day. This is like the second trial. Or is it? Let's see. It's the second trial. It's the second trial.
Didn't it have something to do with the Sabbath day?
Yeah. Had to do something with Mosaic law. You cannot have a trial at night. It had to be during the daytime. So they made it legal, right? And how ironic is that, that they wanted to make the trial legal? Here they were taking a perfectly innocent person, and they had made up their minds that they were going to condemn him, and so that they could follow these laws that were really not of a consequence anymore. They were going to make it legal as they were wrongfully executing an innocent man. Last question then on this section. As we've seen before, Jesus tended not to answer questions with direct answers. Rather, he'd respond in a way that would make his questioners think about their own question. Why do you think Jesus answers the question here the way that he does? Remember the part there he said, instead of just saying, yes, he says, if I tell you, you'll not believe me. And if I asked you, you wouldn't answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. And so then they're kind of wondering, what's he saying? Are you then the Son of God? And then he doesn't answer that. And it's more like, you say that I am. Right? So in other words, he doesn't come out and give them a direct answer, does he? He keeps coming back with questions on questions. Why do you think he answers in that way? What would happen if he would just say, I am the Messiah? What would they probably do then?
Crucify him.
Yeah, they'd say that? What else might they try to do? They might argue with him, right? They would try to prove him wrong, that it would be a regular trial. But if all he says is, if he speaks in these questions, how can they argue with that? There really isn't an argument. Mm-hmm. He's just saying, well, you're saying that I am.
Yeah, he's just confirming that they're saying that
that's
he
right.
Is.
That's right. I'm not going to defend myself. So again, he doesn't defend himself. He remains in control. He doesn't take the bait. He doesn't get into an argument with them. He only says what's necessary to keep things moving along so that they'll follow the steps that need to be followed. So this was the second trial then. Now he goes to both Pilate and Herod. Let's turn to chapter 23, 1 to 25. Well, that's a rather long section, so I think I'll read that one. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, we have found this man subverting our nation He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ a king. So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it's as you say," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests in the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he had hoped to see him perform some miracle. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there, vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him, dressing him in an elegant robe. He sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I've examined him in your presence, and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." With one voice they cried out, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us!" Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again. But they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" For the third time he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I'll have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. So these are the third and fourth trials. He goes on trial before Pilate, comes back from Herod after that trial, and over again, there's nothing that he's done that would make him guilty, but instead he's found to be completely innocent and gets condemned for being innocent. How did Jesus' enemies couch their accusation in different terms before Pilate than they had in the Jewish court? Why do you think there's this subtle shift in accusation when Jesus is brought before the Roman governor? Do you see the subtle difference between the two?
It had to be a reason against Caesar in order for Pilate to have anything to do with it. Otherwise, he would have just put it back in their lap and said, "You deal with it, it's a religious matter."
Right. And I think if we read the other Gospels, we find that that's exactly what Pilate does say, isn't it? But here, they change the wording. Pilate can see through it, but by claiming that he's a king, instead of claiming that he's the Christ or the Messiah, which really is the same thing, isn't it? Especially the way that the people looked at it. When the people looked at Messiah to come, they were thinking of someone like King David, that he would come and rescue them from the Romans. And it would seem that even the Jewish leaders at that time figured out that there was more to it than that. Otherwise, because what were they saying? They were saying that Jesus claimed to be God. But then when they make that subtle switch, instead of claiming that he's Messiah or Christ, they say he claims to be king. So it's a bit ironic, isn't it, that the very leaders who recognize that Messiah was more than just an earthly king, that Messiah was the Son of God, that he would establish a heavenly kingdom, are the ones that refuse to believe that Jesus is that Messiah. His own followers, on the other hand, they don't recognize all the things that are meant by him being the Son of God, and they see him as an earthly king and are waiting for him to set up the earthly kingdom. And they're the ones that believe in him. So we see all these things that just get turned around and upside down, and yet Christ was a Messiah. He was not an earthly king. So why does Pilate not take that question seriously, that Jesus is a king?
Doesn't look like a king. Doesn't have any followers.
We talked about this one too. What, you know, imagine what Jesus must have looked like by this time. It must have been just disgraceful to think that this was our Savior, the one that we, you know, that they loved and followed, the one that we, you know, so dearly loved too. Think of what he must have looked like.
There's a accusation here. It says he opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. Pilate just kind of disregarded that. You'd think that that would be a serious thing for him.
Yeah.
Maybe he just knew it was totally false anyway.
Well, I think, you know, Pilate was not a stupid man. He was, in order to be governor for that long in that position, he had to know how to handle political situations. He could probably see through that they had some other motive involved here. And what do you see as Pilate's main concern in all of this?
His reputation as governor, because it
right.
was on the line.
Okay. And what was this people known for?
Pilate's people?
No, the people that he was ruling here in Israel, in Jerusalem. They were Pilate's people in a way, but what were they known for in Jerusalem? What did he just had to do a little while before? He had to put to death about 30 people, I think, because there was an insurrection. They were troublemakers. They didn't like the fact that the Romans were there. Most other people, when the Romans would come in, would just say, okay, they've beaten us now. They'll let us be. They'll give peace to us. You know, the Pax Romani. Not in Israel. Not in Israel. There, they would resist, you know, time after time. They didn't want the Romans telling them what to do because it interfered too much with their following the Mosaic Law. It finally, it leads to the ultimate conflict between Rome and Jerusalem and what happens in Jerusalem.
It's destroyed.
The city gets destroyed. I mean, it's laid siege. The people die of starvation. There are all terrible things happening in the city. And so Pilate, in this situation, I believe, we can see lots of evidence of it, that he's just trying to keep the peace. If it means he has to put to death one innocent man, oh well, you know, at least I've kept the peace.
Was this the same Herod that wanted to find Jesus when he was a baby and to kill him?
It was actually his father. That's the next question, so why don't we jump to that one. That was Herod Antipas that tried to kill Jesus as a child. This was the Herod that killed John the Baptist. He was the one that was, let's see, what else did I say about him? Oh, yeah, he's a pretty bad guy. His brother Philip married Herod's half-sister, and so Herod steps in and has her get a divorce so that he can marry her. Pretty bad guy. And then Salome, the relationship with Salome, that's his stepdaughter. There's thought that that was not all on the up and up either. Just a very wicked, evil man. And he was looking for entertainment. When he asked Jesus to come to see him, he was looking for entertainment. Jesus saw that too and just did nothing. We're at the end of our time. Let's see. The last question is kind of an important one. Maybe we can start with that next time. But the person who gets released is the person who's guilty. The person who gets condemned is Jesus. That's Barabbas is released. Compare yourself to Barabbas. How has something similar to what happened to Barabbas happened to you? Obviously, we're like Barabbas, aren't we? We are guilty, and yet we're released because of what Christ happened to him. So let's start with that section next time, and then we'll finish it up. Next week is the last week of this class. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
for your participation.
Yeah.